It takes a cast of hundreds of people every year to make TechFest happen. Between our researchers and our program managers and all the support staff, it's really an event that the entire division as a whole gets involved in and gets behind.
When we first started TechFest, I actually wondered whether we would even get very many employees to come. The first year I was just flabbergasted. So many people showed up.
TechFest is important for Microsoft Research because it's a jumping off point for great conversations. Each year we get about 300 technology demo proposals submitted. From there, we spend the next couple of months looking at what's happening across all of our different labs to really find the best of the best. And in the end, we pick about 150 of them to bring to Redmond and to put into a show floor.
The importance of doing state-of-the-art research is vital for the continued health of the company. Sometimes the impact is immediate, and sometimes the impact is over the long term.
I always get excited when I, you know, go around to the different booths. I get a chance to see the research projects, and there's always something that surprises me. There's always something new that I didn't even know we were working on.
We treat technology transfer much more as a social process than as a logistical and mechanical and process-based one. In the end, we try to balance out really amazing technology, but also really looking for what are the things that will change people's minds. What are the things that people just simply couldn't imagine it's possible to do, and now it's possible to do.
It's really valuable for us to be able to have our researchers interact with our employees, to really give them a sense of what we're doing, but also to learn from the employees or what's important, what are they working on.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senior Vice President, Microsoft Research, Rick Rashid.
You always think it's fun having the big voice in the loudspeakers announcing you coming on stage. You know, I can remember back when I was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University during the 1980s. I don't think I ever had a big booming voice welcome me on stage. You know, it's not quite like being a rock star, but, you know, It makes you feel a little bit better. So I want to welcome you all to TechFest. This is, probably like our 10th now. We started TechFest in 2001. I want to sort of set the stage for you a little bit. Obviously, most of the fun of the day is going to be going around looking at the various technology demos and having a chance to talk with the researchers. But I wanted to set the stage a little bit and talk about sort of, you know, who we are and, you know, why we do what we do. You know, why is basic research an important thing for us and for Microsoft? Now, when you think about doing sort of fundamental basic research, which is what we're engaged in, you know, there are a number of values that you can derive from it. You know, clearly, you know, we think that investment in basic research is essential for survival of our industry, of the technology industry. I mean, we're built on investments in research. We're built on R&D. But I think it's also increasingly the case that computer science isn't just impacting the technology field in the traditional sense of the word, but in fact, we're also increasingly impacting, you know, many areas of science and technology. And you'll see more about that, you know, during the course of today as you see some of the demonstrations that we're doing. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. And then even stepping beyond that, I think the field has a lot to offer in terms of addressing some of the key societal problems that we have. And I'll talk a bit more about that. Well, how do we all get started? In 1990, there was a memo that was actually written to the board of directors at Microsoft by Nathan Myhrvold. And Nathan argued that it would be important for Microsoft, which, by the way, was a very small company back in 1990, to engage in long-term basic research. And, you know, despite the fact that, you know, the company just crossed $1 billion in sales, you know, now it's over $60 billion, just to put it in perspective, you know, a relatively small number of products. But Nathan, you know, argued strongly that it was important for the company to think long term and to think about the future, you know. And so it was really an act or an agreement by the board of directors that really started the process of creating Microsoft Research. You know, I came into Microsoft in 1991, so Now, I was recruited over the spring and summer of 1991. I said no a lot, and so I think Nathan internally referred to me as Dr. No for quite a while. But he was very persistent, and I finally agreed to come to Microsoft to start Microsoft Research in September of 1991. And before that, I'd been involved in doing a lot of different kinds of projects, operating systems projects such as the Mach operating system, which is today the basis for the Mac OS X operating system and the iPhone operating system. I developed some of the early network computer games like AltoTrack. Developed a number of key technologies and technologies ideas such as NUMA or non-uniform memory access architectures and things of that sort. So that was my background. When I came to Microsoft, I wanted to build a strong basic research organization around three fundamental concepts. And this right here is the oldest slide in my deck. People always say you should measure your decks by how old your slides are. Well, this one is 18 years old. I've been using this slide for 18 years, and that's because we've had exactly the same mission statement, for the entire history of the organization. I don't know if that sets a record or not. The first part of our mission is really expand the state of the art. I mean, we're about moving knowledge forward, moving the state of the art forward in the areas that we do basic research. And an important part of that statement is the fact that there's not the word Microsoft in it, right? This is about being true to the individual areas of research that we do and moving the state of the art forward. It's not about saying, well, we're going to work on something just because it's interesting to Microsoft. And I think that's particularly important because unless we're moving the state of the art forward, in the areas that we're working, I don't really think we're ultimately going to be that valuable to Microsoft or anybody else. So we think it's important that that be the first part of our mission. Now, when we have great ideas, then the second part of that mission statement comes to play, which is, if you've got an idea that makes sense, we work really hard to get those ideas into our products. And over the course of the history of Microsoft Research, you saw that in the video earlier, virtually every Microsoft product that we have today has, in fact, been impacted, by the research that we do. Either that there's technologies from our research organization in the product, or the product itself comes directly out of our research, or the technologies used to create the product came out of our research group. Ultimately, all this is about making sure that Microsoft and the technology industry and the field and ultimately the society really has a future. I mean, that's why we invest in basic research. We've grown quite a bit over the years, from I think that 1991, that's one. that was me. And now we're about 850 PhD researchers spread around six research labs around the world. And to put that in perspective, that's sort of roughly the equivalent of having created a Berkeley computer science department size faculty every year for every year that Microsoft Research has been in existence. So that gives you a sense of about how we've grown and what we've been able to do over that period of time. Here is kind of a sense of sort of how we're distributed around. The named entities here are specific groups, either research groups. There are six research groups: Redmond, Silicon Valley, New England, Cambridge, India, and Asia. Then we also have some technology centers in Cairo and Aachen, Germany. But we're also very much involved in doing collaborative research with other organizations. We have joint technology centers, labs, cooperative organizations that we work with around the world. We have, for example, a center for computational and systems biology in Trento, Italy, that we work with. We have a center for high-performance computing in large-scale multiprocessing in Barcelona that we work with. There's a joint research center with INRIA, the French IT research organization, in Saclay near Paris. So if you look out around the world, it's not just our footprint as a single organization that you'll see, but you'll see us engaged with many other organizations around the world. In Latin America, we have something called the Virtual Institute, where we collaborate with researchers in a number of top Latin American universities and bring them together to do research. Now, when I came to Microsoft, you know, my idea of how to do basic research was very much built on the way I'd been doing basic research when I was at Carnegie Mellon. And so in some sense, you know, the way we're organized for innovation was the way, you know, Carnegie Mellon University's computer science department was organized for innovation back in the 1980s. That was my model. That's the approach I've taken. I've continued to use that approach all the way through. It's been an important part of what we do that we're open in our research. We publish our research. If you go out on our research.microsoft.com website, you can find out who works for us. You can find out what they're working on. In many cases, you can download their papers. You can download demos. You can download code in many cases as well. So we've been very aggressive about getting our ideas out to that academic community in the form of peer review publications. We bring a huge number of visitors. I don't even know the number. It's very, very large into the organization each year. At any given point in time, there are dozens of visitors, you know, from other universities, from other research organizations or government agencies. We bring an enormous number of interns in, and we run basically certainly the largest PhD internship program that I'm familiar with in the technology field. It may even be the largest in the world. We have over 1,000 PhD interns working in a Microsoft research lab, you know, at some point during the year. Just in Redmond, last summer, we had over 350 PhD interns. You know, and to put that in perspective, you know, the United States produces about, you know, 1,800 PhDs a year in the field of computer science. So over the course of their careers, a large fraction of all PhD students in the United States will likely work at some part of Microsoft research. So there's a lot of interaction. You know, in some sense, you know, as I did the calculation once, I believe we have more graduate student hours in graduate students working at Microsoft Research than any university has in the world. So in some sense, you know, we're both a very large faculty and a large number of students that work with us. I mentioned that one of our key goals was moving the state of the art forward. And while we don't measure ourselves by the number of papers, but rather by the quality of the work that we do, I wanted to put this up just to give you a sense of what the level of impact is on many of the major conferences today. I mean, I think we're either the number one or one of the top publishing institutions in the field of computer science. And in many top conferences, you'll find anywhere between, you know, 15 to 30% of the papers will come from someone at Microsoft Research. So there's a huge impact there. Now, there are lots of reasons, you know, why you might think about doing, you know, basic research. You know, for me, the key value, the key reason that I believe Microsoft invests in long-term basic research is this top point, which is it gives Microsoft agility. It gives Microsoft the ability to change when change is important. You know, research provides a reservoir of technology and ideas and expertise so that if you have a new competitor, if you have a change in technology or a change in the business climate, you know, if Microsoft needs suddenly to react and change or enter a new business, you know, the chances are good that within Microsoft Research, we will already have been working in that area. We already have some of the best people in the world in that area, and we'll be able to help the company enter that new space and to help lead it in a new area. You know, whether that is things like, you know, getting into the game console business, you know, in 1999-2000, whether that's in entering the large-scale internet search business, you know, with our search technologies and Bing, whether it's getting involved in, you know, historically in things like, you know, streaming media and things of that sort. So yes, you know, in most of the traditional measures of value that people often assign to basic research, you know, Microsoft Research, you know, helps the company do that. You know, probably a quarter or more of our patents come out of our research organization, And that's certainly valuable to the company. In fact, Business Week had an article a few weeks ago where it said that, you know, it rated Microsoft's patent portfolio as the most valuable patent portfolio in the technology industry. And IEEE had published a study a couple years ago saying that we had the highest scientific value of any patent portfolio in the technology industry. So clearly that's a value to Microsoft. But I would argue that's not why we do it. It's a value. You know, it's a consequence of having a great research group. You know, problem solving. People often say, well, you should have a research group so you can do problem solving. You can solve the corporation's problems when they have them. Well, that's great, and we love solving problems. I mean, I personally love solving problems. I love it when somebody comes to me, they've got some hard problem. You know, I can noodle on that, think about it, figure out a solution. That's great. I really enjoy that, and most of our researchers enjoy doing that too. But that's a consequence of having a great research organization. It's not really why you do it. You know, early warning system. Again, people often say you should have a research group because it's a great early warning system. And it can be, you know, although sometimes the warnings aren't always heeded. You know, you might say, you know, hey, this internet search thing might be big someday, you know. You know, you can say that, right? And, you know, people might not listen to you. But the point is, these are all values that a basic research organization brings. And Microsoft participates in all these values. I mean, you know, these are all great. Everybody's super excited about what they get from the research organization. But at the end of the day, this isn't why you do basic research. You do basic research for the point I made before, which is you do it to survive. You do it so that if something awful happens, you know, or if there's some big change, you can react to it. Now, we do drive a lot of technologies into our products, you know, and that is an important part. Remember, that was the second part of our mission statement. You know, we do that, you know, and it's an important part of what we try to accomplish. And if you go through, you know, there's so many things. I mean, I was involved in starting the group that eventually became the digital media division of the company. Started that as a research group in 1992, and you know, we built it up into a product team and spun around in 96. You know, I ran the early DirectX team in the early days. You know, because of a lot of the 3D technologies we developed in research, you know, were becoming important in our Windows environment. I started the first e-commerce group in the company. You know, all of the key data mining technologies that went into SQL 2000, you know, came out of a collaboration between the research organization and our product teams. You can look today at things like, you know, the Xbox or Bing or, you know, many of the products that Microsoft does, and many of them came historically, you know, from collaborations with the research organization. You're not expected to really read through this list. This is just the short list of sort of key things that went into Windows 7, Office 2010, and some of our other recent releases. Now, I mentioned that, you know, that ultimately, you know, this isn't just about Microsoft, but it's also about, you know, solving key problems. And if you look at the research that we're doing, increasingly you'll see that we're not just, you know, impacting sort of near-term Microsoft technologies or even computer science technologies, but increasingly working in areas such as healthcare, environment, energy, and education. So in the healthcare, for example, you know, we're one of the key players in the search for a vaccine for AIDS. We've been developing a lot of the technology that's used within the AIDS community today. And we've been developing, you know, coming up with new ways of looking at the way the immune system reacts to the AIDS virus and how we can address that in the development of new vaccines and new treatments. Similarly, we've been looking at other diseases, AIDS, malaria, hepatitis C. You know, more recently, we've just published a paper in Science a couple weeks ago. You know, some work that we've been doing in the area of looking at asthma and some of the causes for childhood asthma. So increasingly, computer science technologies and the ideas from the field, the theory of computer science, are having an impact in biology and medicine and healthcare. Similarly, environment, you know, as we start to think about building much larger scale models and sensing more information, you know, again, I think the field of computer science can make a big difference there. And, for example, we have a large-scale project looking at the water quality in the Russian River Valley in California and the watershed and collecting lots of sense data, collecting that information, and then disseminating it to scientists. Energy, education is another area where we've been developing a number of key educational technologies to try to be able to get young people more excited about engineering, more excited about learning, programming, learning technology, and some of those technologies, in fact, already in use in schools around the world. So with that, I'm going to give you, so I'm going to stop talking now and let you get a glimpse of some of the things that you're going to be, we'll see later today. And I want to introduce Desni Tan and Dan Morris, who are going to show you what I think is a pretty fun research project looking at new forms of user interface. Desni? Or Dan?
Awesome. Can I steal your clicker, Rick? Awesome. Thanks, Rick. So Desni and I are going to be showing you some real cool new technology we're working on in the area of mobile natural user interfaces. So you're going to hear a lot this week about natural user interfaces. You've probably heard of that before. Systems that make communicating with computers more intuitive, more like the way we interact with the rest of the world that isn't computers. This is an area where Microsoft has already made a lot of progress. You've heard about Microsoft Surface. You've heard about Microsoft Natal. These are both systems that make interacting with different types of computers more natural. The question we're really interested in is, what do natural user interfaces look like on the go? What's a mobile natural user interface? And the specific approach we're taking in our research is to look at on-body interfaces, meaning if we can turn your body into the user interface, you have an interface that goes with you everywhere. So we're looking at what sensing technologies can we use to build on-body interfaces that are natural and always available. I'm going to show you two technologies that we're working on in this space. The first of these two we call muscle-computer interfaces. So it turns out your brain uses electrical signals to communicate with your muscles. When you want to move your arm, your brain sends an electrical impulse down your spinal cord, down your arm. And we can actually look at that electrical activity with sensors on your arm. So our vision is, imagine you could put on a slick little armband like this that had electrical sensors in it, looked at the activity that was going on your arm, and figured out what your hands and fingers were doing. Then you could have an interface that went with you everywhere, so you could communicate with a computer, with a display on the wall, with your cell phone. And you can imagine this having a wireless link to a nearby computer or to your cell phone in your pocket. Now, that's our vision. We're not quite there yet, but we're a lot farther along than where we started. Where we started was clinical muscle sensing technology. This is a technology that's used for rehabilitation and a variety of other medical purposes. It looks something like this. Typically, in a clinic where this is used, you have these electrodes that are kind of glued to your arm and have these big cables on them and cost a ton of money. So we've come a long way from there. Where we are now is we've built a prototype of a wireless muscle sensing unit that can sense and decode finger gestures. And so now I'm going to turn things over to Desni for a quick demo of what this looks like.
Thanks, Dan. So hopefully you guys can see me, because I've got a couple of these stylish armbands on me. These are actually hot off the presses, so these are the only two that we have, so you'll see me treating them fairly carefully. If you look up at screen, what we have here is sort of a backstage view of the data. You'll see sort of data streaming across. That's the signal that's coming right off the electrical muscle activity on my arms. If you see me pinch my finger, so I'm going to pinch my middle finger down on the lower left, you'll see the computer start to recognize my finger gestures based on the electrical activity. Now, I've mapped my right hand to a strumming gesture, that's the upper right. And in case you don't already know where we're going with this, let's go ahead and swap to the game. Let me see. Looks like my Xbox doesn't want to play today.
It's not research if it's not high risk, right? That's what you guys come here for, right?
Well, we're going to be showing this in the booth. Let's go ahead and swap to video.
Awesome.
So swing by our booth later, and I'll show you this thing running live. The Xbox just crashed. So could I get the slides, please? So obviously, Guitar Hero isn't the be-all, end-all app, and we're exploring other mobile scenarios as well. Computing on the go, controlling your music player as you run. Maybe your hands are busy and you want to type your email. All things we can do with these sensors. Here's one that we sort of coupled to a different technology, because we also don't project that this is going to be the only technology, input technology, that we have out there. In fact, we've coupled this particular one to the Microsoft Surface. So in the upper left, you'll see the armband sensing which finger is touching the surface in order to change the commands on the surface. In this case, simply changing the color that you're drawing with. So the muscle sensors are sensing which finger is touching the surface, and the surface is sensing where on the surface you're touching. On the bottom left, you see a slightly different version of this. So user there starts the gesture on the surface, but because we're on the body and because we can continuously sense your gestures, user's able to pick up the objects off the surface, change the canvas, and then throw it back onto the surface. So we really grow the interaction space around the surface device. So let's move into a second technology that we're going to show today. In this case, using bioacoustics rather than electrical activity to turn the arm into an input surface. So this was work done with Chris Harrison, who's actually out here in the crowd today, one of our recently awarded 20 graduate fellowship students. And congratulations to all the students out there who have just received this award. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to try to turn the arm into a tap surface, much like that. Now, if we slow it down, it's a little bit disturbing, but you'll see the mechanical energy propagating through the arm, even with fairly gentle taps. So it turns out that the arm is not uniform, and so based on the energy patterns that we see at various points in the arm, we can actually determine where on the arm you're tapping. This is a device that Dan's got on right now. It's got a couple of vibration sensors. In fact, two arrays of five vibration sensors, each fairly well tuned to a specific range of frequencies. So actually, let's go ahead and look at the signal. Dan's got the device on right now. So squiggly lines each represent one of the sensors. And as Dan taps on his arm, you see the squiggly lines sort of move. The bottom part of this is the process signal. So the computer's segmenting the signal. It's realizing when Dan's tapping on his arm. And if you look at the upper left of the screen, we've gone ahead and mapped a bunch of points on his arm to different commands. So do you want to show him the
lock-up interface? Sure, let's fire up the demo now. So you can imagine that I'm using this to control, say, my mobile phone. I'm on the go, my arm is always with me, and if my arm is my touch screen, I can break out commands anytime I need to. So let's say I want to go check my email. And I'm doing this just all by tapping on my arm. Looks like I have some important email from Desney about getting our TechFest demos done on time. Some important email from Scott Saponis, by the way, the rock star intern you saw playing Guitar Hero in the other video. Let's go back out here. Again, I'm doing all this by just tapping on my arm. Let's take a listen to some music. I hear that Microsoft Research Songsmith has some pretty awesome music. Let's take a listen there. All right, I'm on the go. Put on my tunage without actually taking my phone out of my pocket, you can imagine. Let's go back out to the main menu. Let's play a game real quick. Take a look at some, you all know this game. Play a little bit of Tetris, because the world really can never get enough Tetris, is what I say. So far, so good. I will not make you sit through a whole game of Tetris. I think you get the idea. Let's head back out to our phone. So that gives you a pretty good idea. Now, you can imagine I'm using that to control my mobile phone on the go. But of course, here I'm looking at a screen that I have in front of me. Can we go back to the slides real quick? So you might also imagine that if I didn't have this convenient screen in front of me, we'd want output that goes along with us, just like our input does. So we're going to show you a video here. Created by Chris Harrison, who's in the audience, our other rock star intern who worked on this. Here we're imagining a scenario where you actually have a projector that travels with you, too. So you not only have always available input, you also have always available output. So here, using exactly the same sensor that I'm showing you, Chris is dialing a phone number on his hand. So you can imagine your cell phone's in your pocket. You never even have to take it out to communicate with it. You could have a variety of menus that you access. If you had a projector, say, mounted on your shoulder or on your chest that was projecting onto your arm. Again, now you have an input surface and an output surface that goes with you everywhere. And with that, did you want to go again?
Do we want to try?
Desney really feels like pushing it today.
This is the best job in the world. I get to stand up here and play Air Guitar Hero.
Can we go back to
that? Give it a shot. I'll just do this for 30 seconds.
Go back to the Xbox, please.
All right, let's see how we can do. So you guys get the idea there. Thank you.
Demo coming through at the last minute is better than not working at all. So we'll turn things back over to Rick now to close things up.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
I bet you want this.
You know, we were joking beforehand. I said, you know, they should set this up so they can change slides by going, you know. And then, of course, you know, to go back, you go, okay. So... this is fun. It's a lot of fun. And actually, you know, this sort of segues, I think, nicely to this slide, which is, you know, sort of, you know, what are you about to witness? You're going to be going out onto the demo floor and have a chance to, you know, see, I think it's like 19 different technology demonstrations, sort of a tiny slice of what we do for our employees, which will have over 150 demonstrations. Typically, we'll get about 7,000 Microsoft employees that come to the event. This is a great way for us to do technology transfer, because it's a great way of building relationships. And in fact, you know, one of the things you may see at some of the booths is that we have little card readers, you know, for the Microsoft employee badges, so that we can keep track of who's visiting, you know, what booth. We can do follow-up. It's one of the ways that we, in fact, you know, help to drive ideas and new approaches, you know, into our products. So I think you'll have a lot of fun. I think it should be interesting to you. And I'll just point up, I guess this is the last slide, but I'll just point up that this is actually just one of a number of events that we do around the world. I was just a little bit over a month ago, I was in India for an event we call Tech Vista. It's one of the largest academic conferences in India that we run each year. And again, there we do a bunch of technology demos, and we bring a lot of students in and things of that sort. That's actually a great opportunity for us. We run an event called a 21st Century Computing Conference in Asia each year. And this year was in Japan, both in Kyoto and Tokyo. In previous years, it's been in many cities of China, Singapore, Korea, really, again, trying to drive interest in technology out to a broader community. In fact, I think I've now spoken to something on the order of 70 or 80,000 Chinese students. Really being able to show them what's going on and what basic research is all about. So with that, I'm done. I think there's a couple of minutes for any questions, and we have some people with microphones and little numbers. So if you have any questions, wait for a microphone, and we'll just see if anybody does. That's great. And if not, we'll head on out. So are there any questions or things you want to know about, or, you know, information about Star Trek? You know, I think the next movie is not scheduled to 2012, although my understanding is it will come out before the end of the world.
Okay, I come from China. It's a very interesting demonstration, and I just want to wonder how do you solve if from, for example, you play guitar, you just record the gesture, you never get the touch information. How do you solve that kind of problem?
It's a great question. Thank you. One of the things we're looking at is actually coupling this with a bunch of different technologies, sort of like we started to demonstrate with Surface. Right? Surface is great at getting touch. The muscle actually gets pretty good touch information. We don't get location information so well. And so as you couple these various things, you know, Natal with its sort of gestural recognition, you can really start to get very rich interaction spaces where we get fine motor movements with these sensors, for example. You know, very precise location sensing with touch, you know, gesture with Natal. As we start to plaster on more and more devices, we start to see a very rich space where you can interact very naturally in the environment.
Very good music. Do you understand me?
I'm sorry. Oh,
okay. Yeah. For that, yeah. If you just detect the space information and the gesture, how fast that maybe velocity and acceleration. Okay. So that means if the people don't have any music training. They use your program, they can play very good music.
Absolutely. You know, there's a whole range of opportunities around designing the experience and the applications for these devices. In fact, you know, Dan Morris here was involved in the Microsoft Research Songsmith project, which essentially did that for voice. So you could sing along and the accompaniment would get constructed for you. I think it's a large opportunity. There's a bunch of different things we can do with this, both in music, you know, in education, but also in just mobile interaction with the digital world as you move around the environment.
You make a great point. When we listen to music, lots of people drum along in the air and lots of people strum along and play their air guitar. And the more of that we can sense, the more we can leverage that natural human instinct to do stuff along with music and actually turn it into a creative experience. We all do that. You know you do that, right? Listening to
talk. Okay, one more question over here.
Just have a quick question on that technology you're using there. Why did you guys decide to follow the electrical impulses as opposed to just the contraction of the tendons? So I would think that just the physical movement would be easier to track than trying to read electricity through skin or whatever.
We did that for a couple of reasons. So we did play around with tendons. In fact, you know, if you couple the bioacoustics to this one, we played around with can we sense the tendon movements through sound. Part of the constraint we placed on this was that your hands are actually quite useful in the real world, and you don't usually want them obstructed. Right? You could put gloves on them, you could put other devices around your hands, but we really wanted to get fairly far out of the way where we could, you know, potentially tuck under a sleeve or at least get the band small enough and out of the way of your hands enough that you'd be able to use your hands as you normally do in the real world. So that was the constraint we placed on ourselves.
And if you're holding something in your hand, if I'm holding this in my hand right now, I can contract my muscles. My muscles can be activated right now without really my fingers and not even really my tendons moving very much. And again, one of the scenarios we're going is not only your hands are free, but where your hands are busy doing something that we don't want to get in the way of. So we can turn this into our controller if we can sense muscle activity, but maybe not just by sensing tendon movement.
All right, one last question then, and we'll let you.
Has there the thought of coming closer to the source of that nerve signal to the spinal cord versus at the appendage? Did you look into that process of taking it even closer to the core?
Yep, it's a great question. In fact, that's where we started. This work grew out of a bunch of brain-computer interface work that we were doing and continue to do. There are certain benefits to being at the appendage. The signal is much larger and it's much cleaner. There's just a lot of stuff happening in your brain, obviously. But we are pursuing the multiple paths, so that's a great comment.
All right, well, thank you very much. And so now, is my understanding is you should go out, and the demo floor should be open for you. And have a lot of fun.
Enjoy.